Thank you very much. Well, I'm last speaker today, and so in that responsibility, what I'd like to do is to take you on a little bit of an easy journey talking about how we think and why, at least in my opinion, the basis of our educational institutions, especially as you get into the graduate level, is about as wrong as it can be and produces not only a bad sense of policy and a bad sense of education, but in fact what it does do is to result in bad policies overall that guide us, especially in the energy area. So, and that's not to denigrate any of my colleagues who've been here talking about very big science that's important and is in very narrow areas where we'll all make advancements, but in the area of trying to link it all together. So let me try and make a case for you about how to think. And so my argument is going to be that in the past, we've had a very predictable change in the way information comes to us and in the way we think about it. If you look at history in terms of just increasing complexity over time, imagine that the Renaissance begins an increasing sense of trying to gather information and make sense of it. It's followed by a scientific age that translates things into more defined products, makes exciting discoveries. We have telescopes, we have advances in geology and geophysics that come out of that. And it brings us to the 20th century and hopefully beyond. And all along that continuum, every step of the way, we've increased knowledge, but we've faced increasing complexity as the world closes in on us. And in fact, we, in response to that, have taken to developing increased specialization. So look at our response to the world around us. As increasing complexity affects us, increasing number of issues that are around us, we attempt to break down incoherence. We attempt to develop specialized knowledge and apply it to problems. What happened? We lost something in the translation. We lost something in the understanding of how things fit together, what they mean as a whole, as opposed to what they mean in a series of silos or what they mean as a series of bits and pieces. And the thing that suffered the most, the place that some have referred to as the lowest common denominator, the policy arena, has faltered because it can't translate individual pieces into coherent overall policy. Well, the problem is it's difficult to see the future, okay? It's difficult to see the future when you can't see very far ahead. And so you forge ahead and you let the market decide. That's the economist rule. Works pretty well. You shorten the time frame. You say, look, we can deal with problems in a shorter time frame because that gives us information that we have confidence in and we can use reliably. Or you just guess. And a lot of what we have in terms of public policy today is just guessing. Well, the result is, for an economist, the wrong discount rate. And I would submit to you, at least I will in these remarks, that just about everything we do today, whether it's a discussion of the oil sands and we forget about the water quality issues, or whether it's a discussion of future oil and gas reserves in Canada or North America, and we forget, we just ignore the fact that on the other side of that is a demand equation. Whatever happened to changing the demand curve? Well, you can't get there until you can get decision makers who start to think about how we live, how we move ourselves, how we transport goods and services, and why we need that oil in the first place. Well, the result is the obvious, and that short-term decision making, which results in wrong resource allocations, frankly, a misallocation of the reward scheme, and an increased effect, the impact on all of us of what we call negative externalities. So what are the resources, at least in Canada, which is blessed probably far more than any nation on this planet with resources that can be used and used in abundance and used in a way that makes everyone better off overall? Energy, water, biogenetic stores. Think about what you have here that is a treasure trove of the original codes of what we have on the planet. Think of how much is still undisturbed here, and think of yourself in many ways as a genetic bank forestry and minerals that can be used all over the world. Open space, highly attractive. You're in the middle of it, and you preserved it as a society. And security. And I mentioned security only not because I want to create any alarm, but to identify the elephant in the room that is going to be probably bigger than anything I can imagine, and maybe a real reason to have, as the previous speaker just said, an energy strategy for the nation. Because a lot of what happens to Canada won't have anything to do with energy, won't have anything to do with forestry. It's going to have everything to do with the rubric of, wait a second, our security is threatened by the fact that our neighbor isn't acting responsibly. I leave you to guess who that person making the speculation is. Energy is the root of all this, and certainly the root of the institute where I work. I want to repeat Eddie Isaac's graph just for a moment and make you aware of just one connection. You can't do without energy. And it is the tie to affluence. You want economic development? You want affluence, or if you want progress in terms of income or benefits, well-being to people, you can't do it without energy. And if you want an example, just imagine living in Burkina Faso on the bottom of that energy scale and imagine what your quality of life is like. I want to just snap through a couple of other graphs in order to make a couple of points. The first one on this graph is just to get you to imagine that we've changed in a predictable way. Guess what's happened? We shifted from wood to coal to crude oil to natural gas. Moving up that curve, the shares have changed over time. No longer efficient to use wood. It's no longer efficient to just use coal in the ways that we used it before. So the energy paradigm is changing over time. And as it does, and here's what I want you to take away from this graph, look at the coefficient, look at the slope of that line, and look at how steep it's getting, and ask yourself how you cope in the future with a line that starts to get asymptotic and begins to make more and more demands on the base resource. So I ask you, can we imagine the role and the impact of something like energy? What does that word mean? Energy. It's a mechanical term, right? It represents the potential to transform itself, to transform other objects. Energy, which is critical to the economy and which demands, by its very nature, high and very often destabilizing contributions from the environment. It's not free. You don't just dig out a hole and get bitumen. You don't just sink SAGD down and drag oil out. There are costs every time you turn around. And to run a world where you run a ratio of 6 to 5 or 5 to 5 to get energy out, just because you're sustaining your current development patterns, not very efficient, and it has very big effects overall on the economy. And guess what? It's all pretty tough to model, even though we try. And many of the people that you've interviewed, of course, over time or done stories about, have done that very thing. They've tried to put it all together. So can you have it all? Well, not without a way, without a change in the way you process and analyze information. You have to think about things differently. I'm reminded of Danny Hillis, guy who has thinking machines, his first attempts at making a supercomputer. He broke a lot of 286 chips into bits and started processing things in parallel. Wrote a code to break the problem apart, wrote another code to put it back together again at the end, and massive parallel processing moves forward. And I guess kind of like Ice-9, it's irresistible and recombines at the end. But it's a modeling exercise that demanded a different way to think about the information that he had and how to translate it at the end. Well, you can't have it all without a change, at least not for long. You can continue in the paradigm that we have today, but it's better to imagine a different way to think about this. And guess what? If you think about it differently and you're successful, you've got a new export commodity. So let me describe for you a dream that I have and which my colleagues at IC humor me about, tolerate my speculation about. Let's have a new paradigm of thinking, and let's use all the best science that we have. And you've heard from some amazing human beings here today. I mean, I have to tell you, some of the advances that I can only just barely appreciate in nanotechnology or in biology are represented here today, and I am in awe of that. Great science. Problem is how to tie it together. Second, in terms of the new paradigm, you got to admit it's okay to be a heretic. It's okay to think out of the box. Not only okay, it's what's demanded if we're going to survive. So we begin to mix thinkers. We begin to mix the way people imagine problems that they see, the way they see color, the way they see edges. So I've created three C's that are the forces that push back from these. There's competition for resources. The world out there is tough. It doesn't like a break in paradigm. And we've got to be able to imagine that we break down or change the way people think about things. Why don't the forestries people ever think about what happens to the fisheries people? Why don't the fisheries people care? The better question. What about mining and water quality? We've got to have cognizance of the interrelationships between problems. There's a new paradigm of how to analyze things, how to build your models. Some of the econometric models that we build at the Institute may just not be the right answer, although they're fully functional and, in fact, represent the state of the art today. And finally, we need to begin imagining that there are consequences to our uses and that stewardship and husbandry is an answer. But more than that, there may be a role for a country like Canada, a province like Alberta, to exhibit moral leadership and to provide not necessarily the solution, such as you might in response to Kyoto protocols, but in fact to provide the moral leadership that lets others adopt more efficient ways of addressing those issues. There's the world we work in, trying to blend policies, technology, and markets. Keep in mind, none of this works without active markets. And now let me imagine that we can build the next thinking teams, either at the university or in the wide world, that can take stock of the trends, long-term trends, imagine data collection in a way that looks forward farther than we're used to, and finally begins moving this information into the design of the teams and the definition of the problems that we're going to face, defines a new level of detail. And here I want to ask you to imagine that the people who get the information that you are promulgating, that you write about, are not used to a level of detail that the scientists are and have to have something far less but still compelling. And then we have to identify that audience and write to them. And who needs to be on the team? Well, I'm proposing that we establish new analytic teams, and at IC we are. And here's an example of one of the teams that we've talked about. And there may be some people on that team that you don't recognize. You may not recognize having a theologian on a team with scientists, big scientists, chemical engineers, environmental engineers, economists. Well, they have a role, and it just in the way they think, that gives us another edge, another way to look at demography, for instance, or another way to look at behavior over time. Certainly AI is a form of research that will give us some advantage in terms of organizing our own data. So here's our model. Think out of the box. Think heretically and mix the disciplines in ways that they haven't been mixed before. We need to start talking between ourselves in a cross-disciplinary way. Don't apologize. I don't have to apologize to anyone for thinking heretical thoughts because, in fact, it may be the one thing that allows me to escape some of the traps, some of the intellectual traps that we've had in the future. Finally, and this goes to you, and the whole reason for me to talk to you is that you are my voice out into the world. And I say mine, speaking collectively for my colleagues at the university. You are the people who translate what we do when we don't translate very well ourselves, and who make that information available to the people who actually make decisions. Remember, those people who make decisions probably don't read your stuff. Now, there may be certain members of the legislature who do, but I bet it's a minority set. And as a consequence, I have to turn to the people that you talk to who in turn talk to the policymakers. So if you translate well, we're going to make progress. Finally, we need to change the public discount rate. We've got it all wrong. I could not make my point any more firmly or any harder. We're using the wrong time frame, and we're using the wrong rate of return. We won't get forward as a country, we won't get forward as a province until we adopt a model that says industry's time preference for money is the wrong one. It is fundamentally 100% flawed in the public interest. You can't extract minerals, you can't use water, you can't pump hydrogen down with the consequent externalities and do it and have the public expect to pay from their own hide 16 to 20% rates of return or equivalent over 10-year time periods. You need a minus 2% discount rate and a 200-year timeline. And that's what the public sector ought to be doing. They won't get there until we organize their thinking for them, and we won't get there until we're truly independent and understand some of the interconnections between the disciplines and finally the spherical nature of the problems that we face. Be independent. Thank you very much.